Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. It's a very special guest and somebody who indeed I know as a friend. And perhaps at the end of this interview, I will tell you on a personal level, you know, about how important he has been to me for the last 33 years. But let me, friends, welcome to the program the President General for the last 40 plus years of the American Irish Historical Society, Dr. Kevin Cahill. You're very welcome indeed to the program.
Thank you, Adrian. Delighted to be with you.
One might be tempted to ask why it took all the decades where you, you know, single-handedly as President General led probably one of the most prominent Irish associations in the whole of America before you would be indeed receiving the Medal of Honor, which you are this year. I'm sure it must have come up, you know, many times in the past.
It did, actually, Adrian. And in fact, many years in the past, the board voted to give the medal. I've always tried to put the attention of giving this medal to various groupings so that if you gave it to a business leader one year, you tried to give it to a labor leader the next, or someone in academia, or someone in the church, someone in the arts. And so the list of people that I've been privileged to confer this medal on is really a remarkable list, going from the President of the United States to senators, but to dances, to Tom Flanagan, a writer, to people. So that I have had a wonderful time, and as this transition comes, and it's the right thing to do, as we discussed, and I have a wonderful group, they actually, more than me, just insisted that there was no way they could get through the 40th year without having me there as the honoree, and so I accepted.
Let's talk about Kevin Cahill, the young fellow growing up in the Bronx, and your awareness through your father, also, you know, a doctor of your Irishness, your fondness for poetry, literature, all of which came, you know, at a period where, you know, many others didn't get around to it. But what was the scene like in your own house?
Oh, it was a wonderful, warm childhood, but it was a large family. Originally there were 10, and then we had 8 who survived. And part of every Sunday evening, I think, was to be able to stand up on the sideboard as a little child and recite a poem or sing a song. And so that became very much a part of our life, and going out in car rides, you had to memorize Irish songs. So it was very much a part. My father was a physician. His particular specialty was tuberculosis. In those years, the Coldwater Flats around Fordham Road were full of, I could tell you, people, Irish people with tuberculosis, and I can remember as a child going with him to those flats, and it made a permanent impression on me of doing pneumothoraces on where you reduce the, put a needle in the lung and collapse the lung. This is in the days before there were drugs, on Irish people, and I can literally still remember the faces of those people.
Was there, at that time, again, one of the things that the Irish were quite slow in recognizing or making part of our Irish culture, going back to the famine, is that why would there have been such a high percentage amongst the immigrants from Ireland of TB? I mean, you're talking about, you know, this had been long after the famine, long after, you know, a period where Ireland was, you know, it was half the nation of Ireland had been annihilated because of famine and famine-related illnesses.
tuberculosis was an illness that was rampant in our country and around the world. It's coming back, actually, after we thought it had gone away for a while. But it was particularly prevalent among the poor and people living cheek on jowl. So in the tenements, and much of what was accomplished by sending people up to the mountains was to really get them out of the tenements. It wasn't, as they believed at the time, sitting in the sun that was going to do it. It was just getting them clear air, and so that in the poor areas of the Bronx, which is where I was born, tuberculosis was a common problem.
Your father, indeed, was a native of Rathmore in County Kerry. And your mother, where was your mother?
My mother's family, also a first-generation family, came in. Her family came from Cork, and I think Monaghan was on the mother's side. And on my father's side, it was from mainly from County Kerry. And I can remember going back as a young boy to the original Fountain Isles, where my grandfather came down from. Rathmore was a big town where we lived way up in the hills, or the grandfather lived way up in the hills, in the Amish Catan, and I just had the great joy of taking my five sons, and seven of my nine grandchildren could come, and we went back to see the remnants of the house, because there's only one wall standing. But so part of the family heritage and part of that involvement in immigrant life was very much something that we were in taught as we grew up, and I've always loved the name of the American-Irish historical. It's not the Irish-American historical, it's the American-Irish. So it's what happened to the immigrant when he came here. And the society was founded in 1897 by, among others, Teddy Roosevelt, whose mother was a Barnwell from Dublin. Everybody thinks they're Dutch, but he was very proud of his Irish heritage. In fact, one time gave a dinner for the American Irish Historical Society when he was president of the United States.
Let's go back to your, you began your medical career, back in 61. How did you pick tropical disease as your area?
I actually had, although I graduated in 1961, I had finished my education, the exams earlier, and I was able to get a fellowship, the first fellowship I ever had, in Calcutta. And I worked at the Institute of Tropical Medicine, but then, being indefatigable and young, I used to go out and help this Albanian nun in the gutters outside, and that she grew up to be Mother Teresa. So I came back from that whole trip fascinated by the diseases and fascinated by the culture. And then I was, during my internship year, every time they'd have an odd case, they'd say, well, look, you were out there, why don't you write it up? And so he began to write, and then, blessedly, I was drafted, as everybody was, right after the Vietnam conflict started, into the Navy. And rather than going off on a ship, they sent me to a medical research unit, and I spent the next number of years in the Middle East and Africa. By the time I came home, I had developed more than a specialty. I had actually written a textbook that's still in press, and so I began to teach and write, and that's been the pattern of my life, of seeing patients and infectious disease primarily, but I never lost that feeling of the whole patient as my father, as a family doctor in tuberculosis. So I've taken care of many people with other diseases other than tropical, but that is what I teach and write in.
Right. But you've also cared for patients in an incredible number, 65 countries. And you mentioned Mother Teresa. The countries that you visited were probably some of the most war-torn places in the world, and so when you go to there, were there periods where you felt that if the word or if people in America and other parts of the world could only know how bad and how desperate this is, you know, maybe there would be better efforts in getting that message across and in getting the appropriate aid there. What was your own gut reaction as you went to places, say, like Beirut and Somalia and Managua, places like that?
I actually have always loved it. I never felt that I was being noble or anything else. I had a job to do. I did, as you mentioned, work in 65 after my wife died. I figured out, you sit up at night and make lists, and I made a list how many places I had worked in. And most of it was in refugee camps, as you mentioned. Most of it was in post-conflict or conflict zones. And I'm still doing it. I actually was out in Somalia just about 12 months ago, and 2 days after I was there and met with a very small NGO community, two of the people I had breakfast with Doctors Without Borders, were shot to death. And I've always gone through life saying, why did it happen 2 days after? Why did I get out? And I would come home from these places sometimes and say to my wife, and she said, you're the only person who can keep me awake after being 2 months in a refugee camp in Somalia and telling me how beautiful it was. But to me, there were so many top, beautiful things to see, the resiliency of refugees, the playfulness of children when you finally could stabilize their place in a camp, and the satisfactions that you got of trying to bring order out of chaos. And running refugee camps is not like practicing medicine. It was a whole set of different demands. And I think a lot of it does go back to your sort of Irish roots, your what makes you what you are. And I've been very privileged to serve at the American Irish Historical Society for these many years, but never forgetting where we came from.
But let the record also show that, you know, that you were among the very first to predict, you know, famine in Somalia, and at a time when, you know, not too many were paying attention. And sometimes we get any reports that we generally get, and I suppose this is media throughout the world, these are short clips of some catastrophe generally after they have occurred. In hindsight, could the tragedy of famine, could that have been offset by aid and help and some kind of proper management, even in the countries where conflict was part of the problem to begin with?
Yeah, staying with the Irish a bit, Richard Burton in the 19th century called the Somali the Irish of Africa. He said they would travel anywhere in the world because they thought they were the best people in the world. And that country, I went there for 35 consecutive years, so I knew it very, very well, and I kept a team and wrote several books and articles.
Yeah.
But your question is very complex, because both America and Russia played Somali off because we wanted a deep sea port. And I watched a country go from really a wonderful country where the elders, there wasn't even a written language, by the way, when I first went, to a country that was utterly corrupt and led by incompetent and cruel people. And so when it finally did collapse, I was there when it was born as a nation, and I was there when it died. And it's struggling now out of death throes. Maybe it'll make it, maybe it won't. But I think there were many, many factors that led to its collapse. And yes, things could have been done differently. Health and humanitarian work has never been a very central thing in our foreign policy. It's always been a peripheral afterthought, or frankly an excuse of covering why we go in to do things. But it should be really central. And Cyrus Vance, who was Secretary of State, became my greatest champion in this area. He actually used to say to me afterwards, that was the one area that I never focused on. And he spent the last part years of his life trying to help me get that central, and we haven't succeeded yet.
When, in 1969, when you were, first called to the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, did you know that, you know, you 36, 37 years later, that you would still, you know, be there, and indeed as chairman of the Department of Tropical Medicine. College of Surgeons, Ireland, one would not have indeed thought that, you know, that a department such as that would have, you know, grown as it, in fact, it did. And, you know, you were a teacher there for over that period, more than 4,000 medical students over the course of your career. Tell us about that as a specialty. Was that a small group whose specialty happened to be chosen as a tropical medicine?
No, it was, you know, tropical medicine is never going to replace obstetrics or pediatrics in the medical school curriculum, but the College of Surgeons is unique in Ireland in that it's not a state medical school. So after 1922, the Anglo-Irish sort of stopped sending their children who wanted to be doctors back to Ireland, and the college had to look elsewhere for to fill their student body. This, okay, it's a very interesting historical question. And they started taking in people from the colonies. So there were Indians from South Africa who were a large group, Nigerians, Ghanaians. And it got to the point in the 1960s that about a third of the college came from the developing world. And that was the motivation for putting a course in tropical medicine there. My insistence was that tropical medicine should be part of everyone's education mm-hmm. in this modern world. And so I refused to take the chair until they would make it a stopping exam for everybody so that you couldn't get into your last year of medical school unless you passed. And that became a wonderful part of our life.
Absolutely.
And my wife and I went over. There's a wonderful book that's going to come out next year in a second edition where we endowed a lectureship, and every year I bring Cyrus Vance and the foreign ministers of England, France, Sweden, the Secretary General. But Seamus Heaney gave one of the wonderful lectures that'll be in the book, and Vanessa Redgrave. So it became a wonderful part of my life, and was not unlinked to the American Irish Historical Society. When President Michael D. Higgins came to America last year, he wrote to me, he said, it's not accidental that my first lecture will be at the American Irish Historical Society. And that's because we met in Nicaragua 35 years ago. And Seamus Heaney, after he got a stroke and he got better, his first lecture was back at the American Irish Historical Society because of friendships that go like a long, long way. And so the College of Surgeons and the American Irish got linked in this funny way of I have bases on both sides of the water.
Let me ask you about your first, you're taking over as President General of the American Irish Historical Society, and the needs at the time. Here was, if it's not designated a landmark building, it should be, but an amazing building architecturally and every other way, you know, right across from
Metropolitan
of Art. And now, that had and still doesn't have, you know, a huge bank account as such. It has always and ever been, you know, a place that one would imagine would be, you know, that the philanthropists around the world would have gathered to make sure that the American Irish Historical Society, with all, you know, of its notability, and that this was something that would have never have had any whatever other problems that might be, that finance and growing, you know, over your 40 years, that, you know, that this was something that you would not, that nobody would have to think about, and yet that's the reality.
Because that's very much the reality. When I became president, or even a few years before I became president general, there was a meeting, and the motion on the table was to sell the building. And I was a very young duck just standing way in the back of the hall and said, well, how can you sell a building across from the Metropolitan Museum of Art? And I remember the person in the chair said, I don't know who you are, son, but we have $3,000 left in the bank account, and we're going bankrupt, and if you want to run it, you run it. So even a few years before I became the president general, I was really getting activity started, getting people involved, and there were wonderful people who, in those very 4 years, would keep that thing going. My wife would come over before every lecture and put pillows under the couch so the cushions didn't collapse, and people would go over and clean it up afterwards. But now there was a construction patient of mine who I put a call in. He used to say, doctor, I have 80 electricians and they can't go in because the plasters haven't finished or whatever you order. And I would get an electricians for 2 days and then I wouldn't get anything. And then a number of years ago, we decided we had to fix it up because it was really in desperate shape. And a lot of the members did. We went into about a $5 million construction phase, and a good part of that's been paid off. We still need help paying it off, and that's where this annual dinner, that is our major fundraiser every year. And so that we had it. But there are good people out there, and they'll, I think, maybe even be better people who know how to fundraise, because that's not my strong card.
Right. Now, you did indeed finally get help from the Irish government to the, you know, again, it was, one would have imagined that this not only was self-sustaining, but the last thing the American Irish Historical Society on Fifth Avenue and 80th Street in Manhattan, surely to God, they're not short of money. But indeed, the Irish government did step up to the plate when you decided that a massive renovation was no longer just an option. It had to happen.
Yes, they did, and I have to say that even during the very difficult economic times of the last few years, the Irish government has continued to make small but steady grants that allow us to bring in cultural groups, that allow us to sustain some of the programs. You know, as you approach 2016, you can't. I was in Ireland last week, and the Minister of Culture, Jimmy Dinahan, was talking about programs, and I said, you know, you can't even think of a celebration of the American of 1916 without getting to the American Irish, because all of the funding, or much of the funding,
right,
was done, and all of the archives are there, and the proclamation is there. Literally, the flag that flew over the post office has been given to us on permanent loan. So the treasures that are there had to be preserved, and I think turning it over to a new group of leaders who, you know, will make it even better, but it's everything was pretty much in shambles. The archives had to be put into acid-free boxes. We had to get programs started again. So it's well on its way to, it's very solid, and I think the group of people who will be leading in the future, and I will not go away, but are really wonderful as a young man. Tom Dowling will become the president general, and he's a person at Goldman Sachs who is been very generous, and he's made the building, not only has he given a donation, but he made it a recognized Goldman Sachs charity, and that's very important so that people in the future at Goldman Sachs who may wish to give a donation can do that right through their company. And so there are, I have many ideas like that that I think people can pick up and do better than I did.
You know, you had mentioned, and of course the Irish American community specifically, and indeed a lot of in the area of culture and art, were more than aware that there was a trove, a treasure trove, in the American Irish Historical Society, and that it was so vast that more than likely, you know, the cataloging and all of the preservation of your documents and whatever, that day would never come, because it was a very slow process. Not only, you know, the cataloging was probably the easiest part of it, identifying and authenticating what you actually had there was something that for years people either didn't understand or, you know, let me ask you, in the area of discovery, was there a lot of stuff that surfaced as the years and as the decades went by?
Absolutely. In fact, there was almost no knowledge of things. People would send in boxes from their ancestors, but we have, you know, even our art. There's a picture on the second floor of the Marshal McMahon, who was president of the Third Republic in France. There was a nice picture there, but no one really knew what it was. There were pictures, so that the art all had to be, and I use friends and patients who had skills in this area to come and tell us what we had, and then we had different archives. During one period, I actually had a bookbindery down in the cellar, and I traded it off to a bookbinder who would do her work there, but she would fix up our books and preserve. So the first thing was to preserve the collection, and then the second was to get into cataloging it. And yes, we found many. We found letters of Patrick Pierce and De Valera's files. So there were discoveries, and I think it really pretty well now is at a stage where much of it is digitalized. We're not the, you know, Fordham University or Notre Dame University historical study. We serve universities all over the country, and I think there was one time a number of years ago, but there were 50 universities that were using it at that time. And so that as Irish studies programs have increased, the importance of the American Irish Historical Society has increased. I actually one time was out in California and saw an old water tower that looked to me like a Martello Tower, that dotted where James Joyce lived in the coast of Ireland, and I ended up getting a 50-year lease on the thing, or a 100-year lease, I forget what it is now, but I put a library out there. And we had, you know, even when, like, Glucksman Ireland House at NYU was started, they didn't have a library. We had duplicates, and so we sent down a library, and we've tried to be as generous as we can to people where we could utilize, as I say, duplicates, and open the building. The St. Patrick's Parade has their meetings there, and various groups, but we have concerts and lectures, debates, and public school children come in and do an annual. So it's been a wonderful growing activity, and as you say, it's right across the Metropolitan Museum, and the Metropolitan has put on permanent loan. Some of their rare tables are in our building now.
So right. Now, and undoubtedly, you know, your very extensive collection of Irish and American Irish books, also newspapers, archives, and all the, you know, memorabilia is, you know, as you say, this is unique, doesn't cover it. These are, you know, original documents that thankfully wound up there, because there really is nothing to compare with the American Irish Historic Society, and it's must be in your looking back over four decades, it has to be a sense of pride, and if you don't say it, I will. You know, you did, because you've had as a renowned doctor, you've had a global list of patients. I mean, obviously, we all have to throw out, you know, you treated Pope John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and that's only, you know, but you did manage, to get their support, and also to have them interested in the, you know, in this historical society, again, the only one of its kind, you know, outside of Ireland. There is nothing like this.
Well, as you say, there are things there that even the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. does not have. There are newspapers. But archives are not the only thing. We just dedicated a few weeks ago a statue, the Hurricane Sandy Memorial Statue. So archives or historical societies have to focus also on living events, and as part of that, we didn't just put a statue. we're setting up an archive so that 30 or 40 years from now, I have a program going where they're going to collect all of the, as many of the newspaper articles, an oral archive. People will be
right.
able to call in. And so my goal here is to make sure that history isn't just the past. History is ongoing, and where I hope this society will continue to focus on the events that are right now happening. And as I say, Hurricane Sandy
yes.
would be a good example.
And again, we should point out, you've mentioned it, but again, we should draw attention to the fact that the American Irish Historical Society is indeed, it is a living society in the sense that all of the various cultural events that are taking place there, you know, contrary to what opinion may have been a few years ago that this was only for the elite and for the, you know, for the wealthy by virtue of, you know, your annual event and the caliber of your gold medalist. It has become, again, a very open a cultural center, which is used all of the time, not some of the time.
Yes, and as I say, if we go back to this dinner, I'm very proud of the fact, looking back over 40 years, that I didn't give it just to the so-called elite. They were elite, but they were the elite in labor, they were the elite in the arts, they were the elite in academia, as well as in church and business. And it is our way of trying to preserve the society by hosting this dinner.
Mm-hmm.
One of the very, I think, the very first year I remember we thinking of, I said, if we're going to go bankrupt, let's go to the Waldorf and go bankrupt. And that's how we went there and we made a small profit, and so that those
mm-hmm.
profits of that dinner were what enabled us to eventually fulfill the dream of getting the building preserved and restored, but also to keep the programs going. And so the more that your listeners know about the society, the better it is, but I would love them to come. A dinner in honor of a physician is not as easy as a dinner in honor of a businessman. A businessman goes to his lawyers and his accountants or whatever they go to. But I do not go to my patients. My patients, some of them, will come to the dinner. But those who believe in what we've done at the society, they should try to, you know, take a look at the website and try to support an event like the dinner. But if they can or they can't, we welcome to. To our home, as we call it.
Yeah, you know, everything again from, you know, for those who may not be aware, you know, your visual art exhibits, concerts, lectures, all are very much there and indeed very much available to those who, again, may feel that an historical society is somewhat like a library and so that all of these add-ons have made it exactly what it is, you know, today. Let me also ask you, in your being honored this year and in the incoming President General Tom Dowling, no, you have, there's a great family connection there. The Cahills didn't walk away from it. Your son, Chris, has done an amazing job, you know, over the last few years there. So it's in the genes, and I'm sure that's a matter of pride.
Chris is the executive director of the society. He really runs it on on a day-to-day basis, but he also is the editor of our literary journal, The Recorder. Is the editor, and then that's for more than 10 years. But when Tom Flanagan, who might have been probably the greatest historical novelist of Ireland, the year of the French and the tenth, when he died, he made Chris his literary editor, and so Chris has put out a book of that. He has his own book of poetry, but he has a collected book of Irish stories. So he's certainly carrying on, but all of my children in their own ways are doing wonderful things, but in the American Irish Historical Society, Chris is certainly the point man, not me.
Just tell us, if you will, about the Recorder, and because it is for those who have known about it and for those who have supported the American-Irish Historical Society, an odd one here and there saying, I have every copy, you know, of the recorder. How did that get started, and can you give us a synopsis of the recorder and what it has its place in literature and in again in the culture?
Well, I think you take maybe a quote from Seamus Heaney, who said it's the best literary journal on either side of the Atlantic, and it has over the history, the 100-something year history of the society, had various evolutions. It focused, you know, at one point on the contributions of the American Irish to the Civil War or in the famine. Mm-hmm. I edited it for many years, put out a book called The American Irish Revival, but that had writers like Jimmy Breslin and James Heaney and Ronald Reagan, actually, in there. And then Tom Flanagan, he became the editor, and then Kevin Sullivan, who wrote Joyce Among the Jesuits and was a great scholar of Irish literature, he became the editor, and then for the last at least 12 or 15 years, Christopher's been the editor of it. And it is a wonderful collection of either essays, poems, but it stands, I think, as it evolves, it stands as a representative of what the American Irish are trying to contribute in this world.
Let me ask you, Dr. Kevin Cahill, has the recorder been digitalized? The varied issues, is that a work in progress?
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress. I can't tell you. Christopher will be able to tell you what status that's at. But I think all libraries are doing that and digitalizing it, so I believe it is a work in progress.
The American Irish Historical Society dinner, friends, is taking place on Thursday, November 7th at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, Park Avenue and 50th Street in New York. And the guest of honor is our guest on today's program, Dr. Kevin M. Cahill. And if you get in touch with the American Irish Historical Society. I know we have a website and a phone number, which I will pass on to. Actually, let's just do this. You can call Chris Cahill or Julia Sweeney, 212-288-2263. This is a very special year. It is a very special occasion. And indeed, do you feel, Lester, that in stepping to one side, you're not stepping down, but stepping to one side, that you have obviously great confidence in somebody who's not as well known to the Irish community as your new successor?
I have great confidence in not only Tom Dowling, but the whole team that is coming in there. There's a new librarian, Roy Lennox. Brian Ruane is the dinner chairman. This thing. So I just think they're wonderful people, and they've proved themselves. They're not just new. I've been thinking of this for a few years, and it seemed to me the right time to put into place what I had thought about a transition that will guarantee, hopefully, the not only survival, but the further success and even greater success of the whole organization.
Dr. Kevin Cahill, we look forward very much to seeing you and honoring you on the evening. And as I had said at the beginning of the program, I have indeed a very good reason to say thank you to you, which is little to do with the American Irish Historical Society, because some 33 years ago, you, as my primary doctor, was the first one to discover that you know, that I had lymphoma, and all in the space of 24 hours, you had sent me to, of course, Dr. Tom Fahey, who was the head of Sloan Kettering Hospital at that stage of the game. And so I'm around today because of your insistence. I was kind of thinking that perhaps maybe you were wrong, maybe everybody else was wrong. But in those days, lymphoma, back in 1980, was a dreaded disease and one of the cancers that not a lot of research was done at that time. I think, and you were one of the first to point out that, and with the, you know, there have been great advances since then in cancer research, but stomach lymphoma at that point was kind of one of the mysteries.
Well, it brings back so many lovely memories, Adrian. Not only those, but of 33 years of friendship. And I talked to Tom Fahey today, who is teaching a course in Salzburg, Austria, to Eastern European oncologists.
Wow.
The world still goes around, and I think I will tell him of your kind comments.
Dr. Kevin Cahill, again, thank you for spending time with us, and it is indeed an honor for us to have you on Irish Radio Network today, Dr. Kevin Cahill.